At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
And on the seventh day, FedEx said, "Let there be packages." From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, May the 30th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We lead today with the economic reality that American consumers want what they want, and they want it right away. FedEx said today it is going to start delivering packages 7 days a week starting next year, all in service of our endless online shopping habits. In fact, the company says the average daily volume of small parcels being delivered in this economy, already a flood, as you know, is going to double by 2026. So, as Marketplace's Jack Stewart reports, it is only good business sense for FedEx to try to ride that wave.
FedEx already ramps up to a seven-day-a-week operation for peak holiday time, but in 2020, instead of cutting back, it'll just keep going, says the company's chief operating officer, Raj Subramaniam.
Coming out of this peak, you know, coming in January, we will just offer it year-round. This operation itself is not new to us because we've done that before.
And so the company already has what it needs to meet peak demand, says logistics expert Chris Hess at Kenco.
They bought trucks, they have airlift capacity, they have delivery centers that are able to run at the peak capacity.
He says off-peak, FedEx probably only uses 50% of that capacity, but the market for expanded services is growing. Around 50 million parcels are delivered every day in the US, according to FedEx. It expects that to double in the next 7 years, and most of it's from our online shopping. Jen Giuliano at USC says Amazon is driving expectations there.
They are competing on delivery time, free delivery and delivery time. So what you're seeing is ever shorter delivery promises.
Last month, Amazon said it was going to move to a one-day shipping guarantee for Prime members. Gordon Glazer, consultant at Shipware, says it's creating a new normal.
All the shippers and e-commerce companies are going to have to adapt to the new realities of 7-day-a-week delivery and one-day turnaround expectations for e-commerce.
FedEx says it's also making its operations more efficient and less reliant on the U.S. Postal Service, and better able to handle oversized items like couches and car parts, which are now 10% of its deliveries. Because really, there's nothing you can't buy online. I'm Jack Stewart for Marketplace.
Politics is part and parcel of this economy. Sometimes it's subtle, sometimes it's not, but it is always there. Today is one of the not subtle times. Netflix, Disney, NBC Universal, and Warner Media have all said in the past day or so that they are going to consider pulling production out of Georgia if its controversial new abortion law goes into effect. Georgia has been something of a southern home base for Hollywood for years now, thanks to generous tax credits. Mostly Netflix shot Stranger Things and Ozark there. Disney did Black Panther and Avengers Endgame. But both companies now say their employees might just not want to work in Georgia anymore. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has that one.
American politics can feel more polarized these days, and that has leaked into the workplace, according to Leslie Gaines Ross.
The workplace reflects society.
Gaines Ross is a strategist at Weber Shandwick. It recently surveyed workers about employee activism.
65% said that if they were considering a new job, they would take into account an employer's stance on issues that affect society.
That could be all the more reason to stay away from polarizing political issues with sizable factions on each side. But perhaps not if you, like Netflix or Warner Media, are in the entertainment business. Peter Capelli is a professor of management at the Wharton School.
Many of the employees that they see as most central, most difficult to recruit, most difficult to retain, are people who have views that are quite different than these views on abortion or earlier views restricting rights of LGBT community.
Otherwise put, many of the stars and key producers and other talent these companies need are opposed to Georgia's law. And they, and workers in the U.S. generally, are in a position to make demands. Scott Dabrowski is a spokesman for Glassdoor.
We're seeing the lowest unemployment rate that we've seen in decades. And so people have options into where they go to work.
Netflix, Warner Media, and Disney have all hedged their threats to leave Georgia by saying they'd wait to see if the law goes into effect in 2020 as planned. That'll depend on how court challenges go. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Big happenings in the New York City public transit system tomorrow. The MTA, as it's known in New York, is going to start a slow rollout of its new tap-to-pay system. Just a limited number of subway stations in the city, not fully system-wide till 2020, but still progress. Riders are going to be able to pay and enter the subway simply by tapping their credit cards or their smartphones. A seemingly simple change, yes, but as Marketplace's Mariel Segarra reports, one that could mean big things for New York City and the rest of the economy.
Pretty much everyone who's ridden the New York City subway has had this experience. You take out your magnetic swipe card, you swipe it, you think it worked, and then you end up banging against the side of a turnstile. It's how a lot of us New Yorkers end up with mysterious hip bruises. That is, if you make it to a turnstile. Joy Sinclair, who's 74, is trying to put money on her swipe card using one of the MTA's notoriously temperamental machines.
It keeps saying, dip your card, dip your card. You put a card in, but then it wasn't reading the chip properly. So I have to be asking somebody to help me.
The new tap-to-pay system is supposed to fix all this. Sarah Kaufman teaches urban planning at NYU.
Tapping is a simpler motion than swiping. It'll reduce crowding at the turnstiles.
And you'll no longer have to use those temperamental machines. Tap-to-pay systems on public transit aren't new in the U.S. Usually they require a tappable transit card. But New York will be one of the first American cities to allow you to pay by tapping a credit card. Ted Rossman at creditcards.com says that could actually have a broader effect. Most Americans don't use the contactless technology many of their credit cards now allow.
I think that a lot of people from other parts of the country and even other parts of the world will come here, and maybe their first experience with contactless is on the New York City subway.
And then maybe they'll take that skill home with them and use it not necessarily on public transit, but at Starbucks or the grocery store. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report, we are going to do the business of sports. The NBA Finals have gone international for the first time this year. Yes, Canada, but you got to grow your international fan base somehow, right? We'll tell you about that. On Wall Street, a little bouncy today, actually. The major indices ending mildly positive. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. According to the U.S. Storm Prediction Center, 500 tornadoes have touched down across the country the past 30 days or so, 17 of them at least in Ohio, many of those in and around Dayton. We wanted to get a sense of how businesses in town were doing, so we started calling around. Dave Barney owns a True Value hardware store a mile, maybe less, from where one of those tornadoes hit.
This is Dave.
Hey, Dave, it's Kai Rizdahl at Marketplace in Los Angeles. Sir, how are you?
Great, Kai. How are you?
I'm well. You got a couple of minutes to chat?
Absolutely.
All right, good. So we're going to turn on the tape recorder on this end, and I just want to ask you, first of all, I suppose, how's it going? It's been a rough couple of days.
It's been crazy around here. We've had, obviously, those huge amounts of tornadoes go through and a massive mess that we're now in the process of cleaning up. But it's just been busy from 7 a.m. Tuesday morning to, 10 o'clock at night, 2-3 days in a row here.
I bet. When they come into the store, what are folks looking for from you?
You know, it's run the gauntlet. We're selling, we've got water, chainsaws, replacement chains, bar oil, tarps to cover holes in roofs,
yeah.
Batteries, generators, anything you could possibly imagine that, would possibly help, because there's still a zillion people without a power, and they're grabbing everything and anything.
Yeah, I bet. I'm sure that you, as the boss, as it were, are working those 16, 18-hour days. What about the people working for you? I mean, can they come in and help you out, or they'd have to take care of their own stuff at home?
Luckily, none of my employees were in the path of these storms, which is really unusual because we're all from the area. I do have, some former employees that have gotten hit, which I feel terrible for them. They're okay, just, loss of property and such. Yeah. But my employees have been great. They have been here. They're here right now putting away a second semi-load of merchandise that we just got in this morning just to fill it up, because we've just been, ransacked, basically.
I bet. I was going to ask you, actually, about your supply chain. Are you getting the stuff you need to get it out to the people who in turn need it from you?
Absolutely. Our True Value warehouse is in Cleveland, which is about a four-hour drive from here. And,
yeah.
And I was here Tuesday morning at 7 a.m., and people were in my parking lot. We don't open till 8. We were out of power, but as soon as I got power up and running, I knew right then I didn't have enough product to fulfill the needs of the community.
Yeah.
So I was on the phone with my True Value warehouse, I got an order to them by 11, and it was on my dock at 6 o'clock. So you're talking 7 hours with a 4-hour drive to fill a semi and get it to me, which is fantastic.
Yeah, it's pretty good. What are you going to do once things calm down there, sir? You can take a couple of days off?
Well, we'll try. We'll probably just try to get back to normal. We've got a second shipment again today, and we're just throwing stuff in the aisles just to get it off the truck and out where it can be gotten to for the customer.
Yeah.
So it's going to take us personally here in the store probably a week or two to straighten things out, and I know the community is going to be longer than that. So we'll relax when it's all done.
Fair enough. Dave Barney, he runs and owns, actually, Barney's True Value in Dayton, Ohio. Ms. Barney, thanks for your time, sir. I do appreciate it. Best of luck.
All right, Kai. Thank you.
We have in this economy some things we really, really don't want to run out of. So we keep stockpiles of them. We've got a strategic petroleum reserve. We've got a national helium reserve, stockpiles of grain and gold. Canada's got a maple syrup reserve. They really do. And China does the same thing. One of the commodities they don't want to run out of is pork. And that stockpile might come in handy now that the government in Beijing has warned wholesale pork prices could rise by as much as 70% after an outbreak of the highly contagious African swine fever. So Marketplace's Jennifer Pack reports now from Shanghai on how that strategic pork reserve might work.
In China, you show affection for family members through food. And according to the documentary series A Bite of China, what better way to express your love than to prepare the time-consuming dish Hong Shao Rou, cubes of pork belly simmered in wine, sugar, and soy sauce. Pork wasn't always plentiful in China. Some people over the age of 60 tell me they were lucky if they could have pork once a week growing up. But China is wealthier now, and pork is plentiful. I even found pork in a veggie flatbread I ordered at my favorite snack shop.
你好，我要那个梅干菜。
I ordered the 梅干菜, which is preserved vegetable, but if I take a bite, yeah, I can see a little bits of pork fat in it for added flavor.
谢谢。
Pork accounts for 70% of all meat consumption in China, so it's bad news for consumers and the economy if prices keep climbing. Zhu Zhengyong is with the state-backed research group, the Chinese Academy of Agricultural Sciences.
Before 2014, the price of pork accounted for 3% of the consumer price index. That was later revised to 2.7%. It is still a high ratio, so fluctuations in pork prices can affect the stability of China's macroeconomy.
He says the industry also provides jobs to hundreds of millions of peasant farmers. China's Communist Party likes to keep pork prices stable, so it set up a national pork reserve in 2009. Here's how it works, according to pork industry analyst Zheng Lili with Chengyi Information Consultancy.
When the government feels there are not enough pigs on the farms, it'll store some pork in advance to prevent a shortage in the future.
So the government will set a target. Like this year, it wanted to store 24,000 tons of pork because of the African swine fever outbreak.
Then the government will invite big slaughterhouses to make bids. The winners will get state subsidies to buy pork from the market and store it in their own freezers.
But the system has limits. Pork can only be kept in freezers for so long. There's limited storage space, and sometimes the government doesn't make it profitable enough for slaughterhouses to store the pork. Again, Zhu Zhengyong with the Chinese Academy of Agricultural Sciences.
As far as we've heard, the government's call to fill up the pork reserve failed because the offer price was too low.
Meaning, slaughterhouses didn't have enough incentive to fill up the reserve. But Zhu Zhengyong says if the government even talks about storing pork, it's a signal that officials won't let prices spiral.
The pork reserve can guide the market.
He says a more direct way to ease the pork shortage is to boost imports, which should be great news for American producers. But since China slapped tariffs on American pork, some data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture suggests that exports to China have been falling. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I work with patient artists to tell their stories to med students or convention goers.
Healing and making a living with art. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 43 points today, about a tenth percent, 25,169 for the blue chips. The Nasdaq rose 20 points, about a quarter percent, 75.67. The S&P 500 up 5 points, about 0.2%, 27.88. Uber issued its debut quarterly earnings report after the bell today. The company went public just 3 weeks ago, you might remember. Beat revenue expectations even as it lost $1 billion in the quarter. Yes, billion with a B, 1.01, technically $1 billion. Shares up about 1% in after-hours trading today. CNBC reported earlier today that CBS and Viacom could be on their way to a merger. Deja vu all over again there. CBS banked 3.1% on that news. Viacom up 3.5%. Bonds rose, yield on the 10-year Treasury note down to 2.21%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Hi, I'm Molly Wood, host of Marketplace Tech. On our show, we go beyond the latest gadget announcements to talk about the ideas behind the newest technology and how tech is changing our lives, our jobs, and our economy. It'll make you think differently about the tech you use at home and at work. Join me each weekday for Marketplace Tech. Find it wherever you like to podcast.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story. And some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million-dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. As the planet gets hotter, the push for renewable energy is going to get stronger. So too, though, might the push back. The first offshore wind farm in this economy started generating power off Rhode Island about 2 years ago, and more of them are in development along the East Coast. One that's a good way along is going to be about 35 miles off Montauk at the very tip of Long Island. You will not be able to see the turbines, 15 giant windmills, basically, from the beaches of Long Island's South Fork, known to most of us as the Hamptons. But that does not mean the project is not controversial. Ashley Milne-Tite has the story.
The wind is gusting on this bright spring day in East Hampton. This vast sandy beach is where a transmission cable could come in and under the sand from the South Fork wind farm. Cy Kinsella represents a group of homeowners nearby who oppose the project.
You can't blame the local homeowners for not wanting high voltage alternating current cables within 15 feet of their homes.
But that's far from his only issue with the wind farm. He says the company behind it, Ørsted, hasn't been transparent with locals about changes they've made to the project or how it will affect residents' electricity rates. Local Assemblyman Fred Thiel agrees the company hasn't always been upfront about its plans. Frustrated, he withdrew his support for the project earlier this year. But he says the company apologised, and today he's back on board. Because, he says,
particularly on the east end of Long Island, obviously renewable energy is important because we're trying to combat climate change.
The population around here triples during the summer as second homeowners flock to the Hamptons and throw on the lights and air conditioning.
They are high-end luxury homes, and they are great users of energy.
The South Fork Wind Farm is designed to help prevent brownouts during the summer. Clint Plummer heads new projects for Denmark-based Ørsted Offshore Wind. He says the company has years of experience building wind farms in Europe.
We've been doing it longer than anyone. We have more experience than anyone. We want to get this right.
He says Ørsted has made changes to past projects in response to community feedback. Retired teacher Deborah Foster says that's one of the reasons she's for the wind farm. She's lived in East Hampton since 1968 and campaigned to keep nuclear power away. But she's all about wind power.
My Lord, we are 100 miles offshore in one of the areas in all of North America that has the most consistent wind. Use it. It's made to order.
She started a group of supporters called Win with Wind to combat what she says are misunderstandings about the project, including fears about huge electric bills. Local utility PSEG says the average residential homeowner's bill will increase by about $1.54 a month once the wind farm is up and running. Foster says she asks naysayers,
does anyone have a plan B?
Other than more fossil fuels? She says there's no room for acres of solar panels. The area is too developed. But local fisherman Al Schaefer says the new industry of offshore wind could kill off an old one.
It's going to be destructive to the bottom where we fish, and it's going to definitely hinder our abilities to make a living.
Schaefer has been fishing the waters off Montauk since the 80s. He's just getting into his busy season.
In the summertime, the days go from 2:33 in the morning until 6 in the afternoon.
Five lobsters from today's catch swim around in a trap just off his boat. He says he doesn't just dread the effects of the turbine's installation. He's worried about the miles of cable that'll link the wind farm to the substation on shore.
They're going to run these giant power cords toward land, and nobody has any idea what's going to happen when they run them towards land. What's that going to do to the migration of fish and things like that?
Schaefer's concerns are shared by fishermen all over the East Coast. They say there isn't enough research to show how the technology could affect marine life. Public hearings on the South Fork Wind Farm will take place during the next few months. They are likely to be well attended. In East Hampton, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
What you wind up doing with your life is dictated not entirely, but a lot, by your circumstances, getting by with what you got. Or, in today's installment of our series, My Economy, doing well and by doing good.
My name is Ted Meyer. I am an artistic patient advocate. I work with patient artists to tell their stories to med students or convention goers, how their illness affects their life, not only negatively, but a lot of times positively. So I was born with Gaucher's disease. It's a genetic illness. I was in the hospital a lot, and I did artwork about the fact that I was sick. And I became very comfortable with the idea of art and medicine as a unified force for imagery and storytelling. Because I had this illness, when I graduated college as a graphic design major, I thought, I'm going to go get a job at a design studio, which I did. And I was so fatigued and so tired that I really did not do a great job, and I got fired. There was a certain point where I just realized I had to freelance, because if you have to take a nap at 3 p.m, most of your bosses are not going to accept that. I just decided I didn't want to do graphics anymore. I switched to doing artwork about other people to tell their stories, and I started Scarred for Life. Every scar tells a story. And I find people with unusual life-changing scars. And once I had a big set of stories around, I decided that I would go to one of the medical schools, and I suggested that all these stories might be a good learning opportunity, because I would hear the good and the bad that doctors had done over the years to all these patients that I was working with. And that's when I started doing my artistic patient advocacy. And I curate art shows now that tie to the core curriculum of the medical schools. The most recent show we had was by a woman with severe multiple sclerosis, who really has very limited mobility left, just her head. But she still makes beautiful images from her brain scans. And it's important for the med students to know that they are dealing with people with full and complete lives. And a lot of times, part of that life is making beautiful art about a horrible illness.
Ted Meyer, he's an artistic patient advocate. You can see his art at tedmeyer.com. This final note on the way out today: corporate shareholders don't have as much power as they think they have edition. Facebook had its annual meeting today, at which, as is customary at these corporate gatherings, shareholder proposals were put forward to be voted on. Among them this year, a proposal that Facebook explore breaking itself into multiple smaller companies. One saying that Facebook ought to hire an independent chairman to replace founder and CEO Mark Zuckerberg. And another to change the way votes are counted to approve Facebook's board of members, saying, and this is a quote in that proposal, Facebook operates essentially as a dictatorship, end of quote. Spoiler alert here, they all failed because Zuckerberg controls 58% of Facebook shareholder votes. All right, we are out of here. The Dow up 43 points today, a 10th percent. The NASDAQ up 20 points, about a quarter percent. The S&P 500 up 5 points, 0.2%. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Haran Bikella, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Depke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation. And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.